Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Tele Roundtable, Maligarh Microfinance and Mission Millions hosted by Grameen Capital India. A few logistical points before we commence the session. For the duration of the conference, other than the panelists, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. To facilitate interaction with the panel, there will be a Q&A session at the latter part of the conference. To queue in your questions at any time during this call, you may press star and then one on your touch-tone telephone. If you wish to subsequently remove yourself from the question queue later on, you may press star and two. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to hand the conference over to Mr. Royston Braganza, CEO, Grameen Capital India, who will moderate this session. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thank you, Melissa, and thank you to, I think, over 100 of you who are already now on the call. Thank you for your time. Thank you for dialing in from across, in fact, I think more than three continents already. And in a special way, thank you to the panelists who have agreed to be here and talk about the Maligarh Committee and the implications that it has in Indian microfinance and the way forward. With that, I'll quickly do a round of introductions so that we know who's on the panel. We would like to welcome Dilli Raj from SKS. Unfortunately, Vikram got called out at the last minute, but Dilli Raj, the CFO, has very kindly consented to be here on this call. So, Dilli Raj, welcome, and thank you for being here at this call. As you know, SKS is India's most visible MFI, having completed the landmark IPO last year, and we are thrilled to have SKS being represented on this call. We would also like to welcome Alex Counts, the President and CEO of Grameen Foundation, a global non-profit based in Washington, D.C., with a footprint across 37 countries worldwide, clearly one of the leading names in the microfinance sector, and inspired by Dr. Yunus. Welcome, Alex. We'd like to welcome Vijay Lakshmi Das, the CEO of Ananya Finance for Inclusive Growth, a wholesale lending institution with a diverse client base of MFIs across the spectrum. Vijay is also the former CEO and currently a director of the FWWB, Friends of Women's World Banking. We'd like to welcome Utpal Isar, Deputy General Manager of ICICI Bank, India's largest private sector bank, and Utpal runs the microfinance business there, which is perhaps the largest bank lending practice in the country, maybe after SIDBI. Welcome, Utpal.
Thank you, Dustin.
I'd like to welcome Mona Kachwaha. Mona is the investment director at Caspian Advisors, the firm that manages Bellwether and IFIF, Indian Financial Inclusion Fund, two of the most active funds in the Indian microfinance space over the past several years. Mona, welcome to you, and thank you for coming.
Thank you, Dustin.
And last, but by no means the least, Ramesh Ramnathan, chairman of Jan Lakshmi Financial Services, one of the leading urban MFIs based in Bangalore. And Ramesh is also the national technical advisor to the government's urban renewal mission. Ramesh, it's a pleasure having you on this call.
Thank you, Austin. Glad to be here.
So with that, we kick off our panel on microfinance, Maligarh, and Mission Millions. I recall watching the movie, There's Something About Mary. And today there also seems to be something about the letter M. From Mohammed to Maligarh, the microfinance sector seems to have come a long way. Whether this is a way forward or back is one of the topics that we hope to deliberate on today. On the eve of India's Republic Day, in the land of two great leaders who stood for the downtrodden and the poor, potentially both of them also famously known by M, Mahatma Gandhi and Mother Teresa, we will focus on another M that has impacted millions. Millions, however, seems to be the operative word. Critics say, however, that the focus on millions has stayed, but the context has shifted from poor clients to profits. It was in this context, with the clouds of the Andhra Act looming large and doomsdayers predicting the death of the sector, that Yazdi Maligarh was asked to lead a committee to provide recommendations to the RBI on the sector and chart really a way forward for the sector. What could be called a bold and emphatic tone that the Maligarh Committee has recommended and mapped out what they believe to be the roadmap for the emergence of a new dawn for the sector. And I would really like to kick off this discussion by reading the concluding para of that report, 27.13, where the committee members write, "Microfinance is an important plank in the agenda for financial inclusion. The future cannot be left entirely to the stating of good intentions. It therefore calls for strong regulation. We believe that if the recommendations made by us are implemented, and if MFIs honor the commitments they have proposed in the agenda, then there will be a new dawn which will emerge for microfinance sector, and the need for state intervention will no longer exist." In what is rather uncharacteristic of me, I will now hold back my views on the report, at least for the moment, and like a good moderator, open the panel up for discussion. The way we will use the format really is a quick discussion of about 3 minutes each, where each panelist would get a chance to share two things. One, their top-line views about the report, and two, one thing that they liked the most about the report and one thing they liked the least about the report. And with that, maybe I'll ask Dilli Raj to kick off. Dilli, for about two and a half minutes, if you could tell us your top-line views of the Maligam Committee report and what you liked most about it and what you liked least about it.
Thanks, Royston, and it's truly an honor to be on a panel with respected Vijay Madam and other colleagues. My take is like this. The AP crisis raised serious concerns on five fundamental aspects of microfinance as an economic activity. Business model validity was challenged. There was regulatory haze, future of AP portfolio, and of course, the probability of contagion risk and funding uncertainties. The single most important outcome of Maligam Committee report is that we have near clarity on almost all issues, definitely on four out of five issues listed above. In terms of regulatory clarity, RBI will be the sole regulator of MFI NBFCs, period. Also, the good thing is that RBI has moved forward and started regulating us on functional aspects. Hitherto, they were regulating us just on the structural aspects like capital adequacy, prudential norms. Now they would regulate our functional aspects like pricing, transparency, governance, customer handling, grievances, customer protection code. What it means is that, you know, it's replete and there is no regulatory void or regulatory gap for anybody to ostensibly to get in and claim that they're filling the gap. The second thing is the contagion risk is mitigated because RBI has very clearly requested and recommended the respective state governments to hold on from getting into this legislative piece. In fact, they are calling for complete exemption from state level money lending act. The third aspect is the funding certainty. There were so many questions about continuance of the priority sector dispensations which drove credit decisions of the banks. Now, it's very clear that that would continue. Not just that, there is a clear-cut mandate to the banks to augment the flow of credit to the sector. It's indeed gratifying to get reaffirmed that we are a national priority. The fourth is the business model validity. It's exactly the paragraph which Royston read out. We do have our place in the sun in terms of financial inclusion, and my argument with force is that we have not lost the fundamental business case for microfinance. What it means is that, you know, the reasons why the mainstream banks stayed away from this credit segment, the perception that it's high cost and high risk still remains at their level, and nobody, whether it is the state government or for that matter, some other banks or credit grantor, seem to have reinvented the model in a quick fix and reach across and fill the void there. We found a need, we filled it, we're finding a need, we will fill it. Now, the final piece is the AP legislation. As you could see, there is a clear-cut recommendation and request for withdrawal of AP MFI Act for the reasons that every aspect is regulated now by Reserve Bank of India. I would say clarity is a need of the hour. Certainty is what the investors want, and that has been done by this excellent piece of regulatory work, and I would say that's the most positive. Now, moving on to the second aspect of what, you know, Royston talked about, is there a negative or a disappointment? Right now, I don't want to get into the operational issues, but at a very, very big picture level, personally, as an analyst, for me, the disappointment is that, you know, we're talking about confluence. the single most important lesson ought to have been learnt out of East Asian crisis has nothing to do with cross-currency exposure. That is avoiding concentration of credit delivery channels. Unfortunately, in India, we had a fantastic financial system, but we seem to have gone back. All the credit risk now is concentrated in the banks of a few banks or the banking system. So we were talking about, you know, devising out several instruments where one could achieve the amalgam of the funding capability of the banks and marry that with the credit delivery skills of the NBFC, MFIs or NBFCs. In clear terms, you know, I would have been much happier to see things like business correspondence being allowed for NBFC MFIs or mobile banking. So that would be my disappointment. With that, I'm giving it back to you, Royston.
Thank you very much, Billy. I think that was crisp and clear. Alex, can we request you to give us a quick 1.5 minute on your top-line comments and then take another minute to single out what you like the best and what you like the least in the report?
Sure. I'm going to take a little different format. I wasn't clear about the format that you just mentioned, but I'll limit myself in time. Thank you, Royston, for convening us. I think the top line take on this is that this is really two steps forward, one step back. The other take is that, you know, this is part of a trend we see in India of the federal government deciding that it is going to be an enabler of microfinance. I think the federal government has come to the realization that microfinance, it's not that it's too big to fail, but that it's too important to fail for the poverty alleviation work of the country. There's quite a bit that we like in the report, creating a new category of NBFC under federal regulation and purview. The consumer protection sections we think are really quite good, continuation of priority sector lending. I think one point we really liked that was we didn't expect was underlining the importance of the kind of back-end information systems of MFIs has a lot to do with the ability of microfinance to go to the next level and be more transparent and accountable and coordinated. The credit bureau sections are quite good. And the reference at the end to a paper that we put out by Professor Kathleen O'Dell about the evidence base for microfinance as a poverty reduction tool, I think was important in a number of ways. It highlighted that microcredit works best when it's combined with other tools, other social empowerment tools and savings. And just it underlines that the government is really looking not to respond to anecdote but to evidence when it comes to microfinance. There are quite a number of things we weren't that happy with. When you start restricting interest rates by margin or by the amount, it's a very tricky, and unless you do it carefully, can be very have a negative impact. There's an element of kind of micromanaging how MFIs do their business that we think was not particularly helpful. And it really ignored the issue of savings and deposit taking, which has been very healthy in other countries that have done microfinance. And lastly, while it kind of pays lip service to the social aspect of microfinance, it doesn't talk about the kind of tools and processes that the sector would need to adopt, including such tools as the Progress Out of Poverty Index that has been developed for India and 35 other countries by Grameen Foundation and the Ford Foundation and CGAP. And operationalize it. So again, but I think that could be a next step. So that's our take. Again, two steps forward, one step back. The federal government, one of a series of things that they've done to show that, again, that they think that microfinance is too important to fail. And in that, we certainly agree. It is a very important part of the overall poverty alleviation, poverty reduction strategy of India and really every other country.
Thank you very much, Alex, for that succinct and really crisp insight on those questions. Can I request, Vijay, if you could share with us your top-line comments and what you like the most and the least in this report?
Like Delhi, I agree on those plus points because I don't want to waste my time on narrating it. The three major points for which I think the report has made things very clear.
But I would like to dwell upon a few things like Ananya actually works with 137 organizations, out of which only 55 are NBFC MFIs. So actually we have substantial number of organizations which fall out of this purview of the Malagaon Committee. We don't know where they are going to be, whether they will be allowed to survive or whether they will have the freedom to do what they are doing now. So that is a big question. Unless non-profit sector is addressed, we don't know how things will work with the for-profit sector. And second is, I found, I think I must have, I haven't read anything so many times in my life like the way I did Malagaon Committee. It is quite restrictive in many ways. Like when we are talking about institutions that are entering the sector with a kind of a social mission, they will not, there is no incentive for them to continue to work in remote areas and unbanked areas where the poor need financial services. Because the stipulation on 15 crore as a kind of a capital is going to stop many of them from functioning very effectively and taking the risk of working with those areas where bigger organization may not be going, because it is not worth working in those areas for bigger organization. It doesn't make sense. And the second thing I feel is there is a heavy restriction on the choice of the poor themselves. They cannot have a choice, once, because it limits the size of loan, and also it limits the number of loans they can get. I was wondering that 25,000 is the maximum loan a poor household can get, of which only 25% can be spent on non-income generating activity. If you split it out, 6,000 and odd is available for non-income generating activity. 18,000 and odd is available for income generation activity for a year or two. Because they are talking about 15,000 rupee loan should be for 1 year period. More than 15,000 rupee loan is for 24 months, right? If that is the case, you are talking about for 2 years, they don't have an access to a larger amount of loan. My experience clearly says that when there is an impact in the lives of the poor, they do spend something on education and health much more, which requires quite a larger amount. And if you are going to restrict the size of the loan, you are actually forcing to go to money lenders or any other sources which is not regulated by this recommendation. So the restriction of the choice of the poor is one of the major concern I have. I'm slightly worried how it is going to affect the kind of efforts that has gone in all these years, right? And time frame, I'm not worried, slightly not clear because it hasn't come out. Now, from when these recommendations, if at all accepted, will be implemented? Because will it give time for those smaller organizations which have, to us, in our data clearly about 20-30 organizations have less than 50 crore kind of a loan portfolio. For them to mobilize 15 crore of tier 1 capital will take 2 to 3 years. And what kind of a resources are sources available for them who will invest that sort of a money in a smaller organization which may or may not survive the kind of a competition that might come from comfortably placed bigger organizations. So there are lots of questions, and then I think I'm slightly worried about the fate of smaller organization. There are 50 to 60 in the country doing excellent work. What will be their fate? So that is the kind of a conclusion with which I have read the report. So I'll join in later when more comments are coming.
Thank you so much, Vijay. I think you are really flagging off something that is intrinsic to the sector, that it has got not only large players but quite a mix. I think from there it's a good segue to Utpal to give us some views from the banking sector. Utpal?
Thank you, Rajan. I think the views across are quite similar, whether they come from MFIs or academics or banking sector. Clearly, the committee has taken a balanced view on the microfinance industry as a whole, and that they recognize this as an important plank in the agenda of financial inclusion is indeed very heartening. And therefore, the recommendation on retaining priority sector status is one specifically which is very important to banks. It's also very important to note that the committee mentions that borrowers remain a vulnerable lot, and therefore the entire provision of customer protection and grievance redressal that they have tried to build in is also one of the major important points of the committee in our opinion. As far as regulation goes, where they talk about regulating the sector, that part needs to be, you know, we are not very clear on how that will pan out. Because regulation specifically in India remains a subject of the elected legislature. And any recommendation or report or any of these regulations which come in, you know, the act, rule, laws which are passed by legislatures, whether at state or central level, will always proceed in that nature. Now, finance being a state subject, one cannot really, overrule a state act with a RBI recommendation probably. So what we need to see is how does that pan out. You know, right now it's only a recommendation. It will need to be first accepted and then, you know, it will need to be notified as a gazette or as a regulation. So that part is something which is still hazy. What, of course, is clearly also on the operational side, we'll have to figure out how it pans out, is monitoring of the average household income of 50,000 as a eligibility. How does one really classify income-generating loans at the front end? What kind of monitoring is required to ensure that all those criteria are met are also something which need to be seen right now. Of course, the whole recommendation on categorization of NBFC MFIs as a separate category and to be kept out of Money Lenders Act is indeed very useful and heartening. In some way, if you notice, the committee has also discreetly stated that in some way, banks have been responsible. They have not done enough to keep a check on the operational mechanisms of MFIs. And therefore, the whole monitoring mechanism that is being talked of, which is at MFI management level, the industry association level, the bank level, and the RBI level as well, all of these monitoring mechanisms, of course, also quickly need to be put in place, whether or not these recommendations are accepted, notified, so on and so forth. But in spirit, of course, most of the recommendations are something that the MFI association and the banks, any which ways together, should go out and put in the public domain.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Utpal. With that, we can have an investor view. Mona, if you could share with us your top-line comments and what you like or would don't like in the report.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Royston, for this opportunity. And I'd like to start with saying that, while you've introduced Caspian, there's one aspect of the funds we manage that I'd like to highlight to the listeners, that we manage funds of our investors who seek double bottom line returns. So we look for both social returns as well as commercial returns in the investments we make. And we are a long-term committed, fund manager and investor representative in the financial inclusion space in India. Having said that, I would like to start with saying that the Maligam Committee report has made several very positive recommendations, and my colleagues have already mentioned those. So I won't go into them because I really agree with all of that has been said. Most importantly, and in a nutshell, not only does the report safeguard and restore the legitimacy of MFIs and insulate them from, all kinds of negative external forces that, the sector has been dealing with over time, it also provides a plan for addressing some of the problems, that concerns all responsible stakeholders as well as customers, those of customer protection and so on. So we really welcome those aspects of the report, starting with, the creation of a separate category, which I think really sets the stage for everything else to follow. As an aside, what I would like to say is that with this creation of a category, it would also help, as a sort of byproduct of that, help weed out a lot of entities who have been rather conveniently using the microfinance nomenclature while not necessarily being committed to the sector or the customer or really adding any value as such. So we're happy about that. I won't go into the positives again because, as I said, we agree with what's been said so far. The thing that really strikes us as not so positive is the way the microfinance business has been defined. It's extremely narrow, both in terms of the definition of client household, i.e., the income level type, or the type of loans that an MFI can possibly provide, or the range of services. Because, the range of services is a very important aspect of us as investors. And this inability, if this comes into force and becomes a reality, the inability of an MFI to provide a range of services to this client group is probably the most disappointing part of this report for us. And, in fact, is a lost opportunity because, this could have been, in fact, an opportunity to really be more forward-looking and even, setting the stage for MFIs in future to provide a range of services, including savings, perhaps in future, rather than, you know, look back and really limit yourselves to, you know, the JLG kind of business that, you know, we've seen ad nauseum for the last two decades. So it really leads us to the question whether there's a need for an NBFC in the microfinance business that has plans to broaden its product suite to really want to be classified as an NBFC MFI in the current form. I think there's a very strong case for the committee and the RBI to re-examine this aspect, and the policy should allow room for MFI client relationship to grow over time with multiple products and services. And of course, they can of course require such an MFI to follow a code of conduct and practices that befit such an institution in terms of processes, systems, solvency levels, etc. So the committee's, our understanding is that the committee has seemingly focused too much on the way most MFIs currently operate rather than really thinking forward on this aspect. And, on this, I also want to add that I think the AP crisis was as much caused by the single product syndrome and in fact, too much of it as by the external political factor. So, should not play into those hands again.
Thanks. I think those are really valid comments. As I introduced Ramesh by saying last but not the least, Ramesh, hand over to you to give your comments and insights on this.
Thanks, Royston. What I'd rather do is to focus on some of the aspects that are complementary to some of the comments of the other panelists. So let me begin where Muna and Vijay had kind of talked about and left off. Let me start by saying essentially the challenge of making good public policies is kind of complicated work because...
Could you speak up a bit? I think it's a little low.
Okay. Can you hear me better now?
Yes. Thank you.
I guess I wanted to say the challenge of making good public policy is that it's easy to state good intentions, but then how do you translate that into operating guidelines, which then allow a range of different players to act in a manner that's coherent? So clearly microfinance is an example of that. You've got a multiple set of players, starting with the customers to the MFI institutions themselves, to bankers, to investors, and the regulators as well. And I have a feeling that if you examine the Maligam Committee report in that context, there are many more questions that it raises than it answers. Mm-hmm. So let me give you my sense of what it means. Up until the Maligam Committee report actually came out, there was a fuzzy definition of what financial inclusion was and microfinance was, and both these were in some sense synonymous terms. But that world changed after the Maligam Committee.
Absolutely.
So what we now have is now a definition of what microfinance is, but not a definition of what financial inclusion is. And if you look at the parameters of what the Maligam Committee is talking about, and let me highlight five of those, which is that the nature of the customer is retail, that the customer within retail has to have a maximum household income of no more than 50,000, and to that customer you will only do a single product, which is asset side group loan, which will have a cap and which will be unsecured, then that's a fairly small, narrow boundary on what microfinance is, and the larger financial inclusion landscape is much larger than that. So we're left with two conclusions, that the RBI, the committee's recommendation was not really to define financial inclusion, but to define something narrower that they are now calling microfinance. And that's fine, but it just means that there's a whole range of players who are going to be doing work outside the narrow microfinance definition, but still doing financial inclusion. And if that's the case, then what happens to those players? Do they continue to get access to PSL or priority sector lending, et cetera, et cetera? These are relevant and critical questions. So let me give you one example. We run an urban microfinance institution, or what used to be called an MFI until last week. And out of the few 100,000 customers we have, less than 32 of them fall under the income category that is defined by the Maligam Committee. But 100% of our customers are what we would call financially excluded. 71% of our customers have no savings at all, and of the remaining 60% have savings less than 20,000 rupees. All of our customers are in the urban informal economy. 22% of them are in the construction sector. 14% of them are maids or security guards. 13% of them are plumbers and so on. So there's clearly a swath of activities in the financial inclusion landscape that doesn't find mention or inclusion inside this definition of microfinance. And I don't have a quarrel with that. If the committee chooses to define it like that, that's fine. But I think there needs to be clarity on saying what happens to those who are operating outside, And will they continue to get access to some of the important support from the banking system, such as priority sector lending? So that's one first observation. And the second is things that have already been spoken about by other panelists, which is if you did need to put some clear operating constraints within what's defined as microfinance, I think a light touch would have been preferable to a heavy touch with the same end goal having been achieved.
That's an excellent observation, Ramesh.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So just thank you all for your first opening comments. Just to remind the participants who would like to queue in their queries, you need to dial *1 on your handphone and you will be connected through the queue for your queries, which will be taken after this round of questions that we will now go through the panelists. Vijay, I'd like to kick it off with you in terms of a question regarding, you know, FWWB and you when you were running it in Ananya, one of the first lenders to most of today's well-known MFIs. How do you see the impact of this report on small MFIs, and what would you say to social entrepreneurs who want to start up MFIs in the context of this report now?
No, that's what I think, that from that point of view, I feel it's a very restrictive kind of a report because it doesn't allow space for newcomers to enter. That is one. And also people, you know, came with the kind of enthusiasm to really start with, start in areas where others haven't gone so far. There could be a problem. Because there is no incentive for people to take risk and then go into unbanked and underserved areas. So that is going to be there. And then I was just reviewing the data. It took about 2 to 3 years for some of the good startup working in difficult region to mobilize even 5 crore worth of equity. So it doesn't mean their work is not important. So it is not that easy to mobilize 15 crore equity, that to tier one capital by these smaller organizations, because investors, particularly private investors, are not interested in small players at all. But it doesn't rule out that they are not doing a good job in poverty alleviation. So there is one set of institutions which needs a kind of a hand-holding. So where will the hand-holding come from? That is what my worry is, because if even the bigger ones, that they went through the same thing 10 years back, they had a kind of a space to grow. Now you have restricted the space for the smaller and younger ones to grow. That is one of the major concerns that we are worried about.
Thanks, Vijay. I mean, Mona, I would like to sort of link that to a question to you. When you were introducing yourself, you mentioned that you were a double bottom line focused fund. With the capping of interest rates and the other margin caps that seem to be suggested in this report, how do you see investors really approaching this sector, and especially the double bottom line investor?
Yeah, well, a double bottom line investor, Royston, seeks both commercial and social returns, right? So I think the 10% cap on net interest margin is an issue. I think it will impact the commercial interest of the investor. And I believe even a reasonable return on equity of about 15%, as the report suggests, which I think will be okay for a double bottom line investor to be interested, the 10% margin does not work. I think it needs to be at least at a 13% level for it to work for most companies, the most efficient ones included. So I fear that this single norm can take more than half the NBFCs out of business. So, in a sense,
you're saying that the tier 3, tier 4 names would actually die on the vine?
Well, I think it'll be very difficult for them to attract capital because, you know, I've been reading comments from some of my colleagues who manage other funds, and while I think they seem to think that it can be worked out, I'm not very convinced by looking at the assumptions that have been made in the report leading up to the 10% margin cap, where I feel that, you know, you can attract capital from even long-term investors at a level that you need to keep your growing a business and taking it to newer clients and newer geographies and, you know, and so on. So I think it is a bit tight, and it will definitely have an impact on inflow of capital.
Thanks, Mona. Utpal, maybe I can ask you here because, you know, in the current stage, the banker's role suddenly has got paramount importance and is, in some sense, the leading actor and can play the hero's role as this pans out. How do you see, in the light of the report, you know, the bankers coming together? I know there was a lenders meeting yesterday. Could you share with us really what's the strategy on the bank side going forward?
For all of the banks, actually, this whole story started much before the formation of Maligam Committee or even the AP regulation. About a year ago, we had formed a lenders forum in which the whole practice of responsible lending had already started getting raised. Over a period of time, we had developed a responsible lenders code of conduct, and this was somewhere in alignment with MFIN's and SARON's code of conduct. In some places, it went beyond. And any which ways, the bankers forum was quite keen to get this responsible lending bit implemented through a common set of covenants for all the MFIs. So in some sense, it's not something which is a result of the AP Act or the Maligam Committee. However, you know, banks have really come together as of now and are really looking at ways in which the whole sector can be taken forward. Now, if these committee recommendations are accepted, then of course there will be certain regulation on interest rates. There will be certain impact on profitability. Many MFIs would probably need to redesign their model on the individual lending, on loan limits, so on and so forth, on multiple lending. All of that will pan out. So I think there is a period of about 12 to 18 months in which everybody would be rediscovering, MFIs would be rediscovering their business models, and banks would be rediscovering ways of funding various MFIs, whether they are NBFCs or non-BFCs. Please remember that, you know, there is a large number of non-NBFC MFIs which also access bank funds as of today. And that's true for across the entire banking sector. There are 330 MFIs registered with SARON probably. You know, I might be off by a few, but and most of them have access to bank finance. So it's not really a function of only being an NBFC MFI and being regulated under this act as and when it comes in.
Thank you, Utpal. Just one quick question more to you, Utpal, because the RBI has subsequently, you know, even this morning come up with a circular in addition to their earlier 19th Jan circular on refinancing, on the rescheduling of loans. So is the restructuring of advances, is there something there that you think would encourage the banks to open the tap again to the sector?
See, basically, banks are today looking at ways and means of providing liquidity to the sector. There are many ways in of doing this. One of the ways is to look at cash flow gaps and then try to finance that cash flow gap. Another way is to restructure the loans to the MFIs and therefore provide some liquidity. Any which ways, the asset liability management of the MFIs is in their favor. So while their average maturity of loans that they borrow from banks is about 2 to 3 years, the average maturity of their assets is about 52 weeks or you know, around that. Therefore, the liquidity position is inherently in favor of the MFIs. If there is more favor required, then, of course, many banks are considering. And, of course, yesterday in the forum also we took a view on this. And I'm sure a combination of, you know, reschedulement of bank loans added to some cash flow funding gap, funding of the cash flow gap put together, would come out with a very good package for the interim period while, you know, this crisis pans itself out. The portfolio in AP gets rationalized, operations resume, collections start coming in, rest of India portfolio in proportion to AP portfolio starts growing so that the cash flows from there also come in. And I'm sure over a period of next 12 to 18 months, things will kind of come back to normal.
Thanks, Utpal. Alex, maybe I'd like to you know, bring to your attention an interview that happened with Mr. Maligam over the weekend by a leading Business Daily, where he was quoted as saying that microfinance companies have been neglecting the poor. Given Grameen Foundation's focus on the Grameen philosophy of, you know, the war against poverty, how would you see, you know, this report? Do you think there are strengthening the hands of those who are pro-poor, or is it in some ways losing that opportunity?
Well, I think, you know, I think there's some truth to that. I think that the MFIs, you know, microfinance continues to, you know, evolve and reinvent itself in a lot of good ways and sometimes in some negative ways. I think that two ways in which microfinance, especially in India, could serve the poor better are, number one, for organizations to figure out which segment of the poor they really want to specialize in and serve well. I think they can serve multiple segments, but I think with a, probably a different product line. And if they're if they're serving primarily the kind of working class or the middle class, I think that they should be transparent about that, and probably they have a different series of claims to make about their role in poverty reduction if they're dealing with the near poor or a different segment, and it also has implications for products. Secondly, I think that for those serving the poor, because I think a lot of people have made claims and developed products as if there's the poor are one kind of homogeneous group that they are serving and serving well, and I don't think that's always been the case. The second thing is I think that going to products, I think that MFIs could do a lot more to, even within current regulations, to add on or augment or refine products to really better meet the needs of poor clients. And so it's fundamentally on issues of both targeting and product mix and product segmentation that I think microfinance generally and microfinance in India can make some further improvements. And to that extent, I would agree with what was said in the interview.
Thank you, Alex. I've intentionally kept the two MFIs for the end of my round of questioning, but Ramesh, to you first, really, do you see MFIs scrambling to come under the new category of NBFC MFIs? Do you see them needing to revisit their business plans and revise their strategies? And do you see mergers and acquisitions on the anvil, really, for the sector?
I have to say, Royston, that I believe that by the time you actually see notification of this, there will be substantive changes in the recommendations. Because absent that, there's a hell of a lot of churn that's going to happen. Because, you know, it's almost like a barbell. If you read the committee, it says that if you are an NBFC MFI, you have to have 90% of your portfolio inside this fairly restrictive single product category.
Hello.
And if you're not, then you can't have more than 10%. Now, in real terms, what does it mean for a particular player in this space? If they are at 60%, they have a choice to make, which means either gravitate into this space and what are the relative advantages of being considered an NBFC MFI. I don't see any except release from state government regulations and, of course, continuing access to a priority sector lending. But that means you'll have to make a substantive amount of changes in the business model, and Utpal referred to that, to either go in or to say we'd like to opt out and therefore reduce the number of clients that you want to have who are poor below the 50,000 rupee category and increase customers who are clients who are not. And that would obviously not be great with respect to serving the needs of the poor, because you'll have less and less focus on those who would want to actually acquire customers under the threshold. But I don't think that churn would be pretty to watch as institutions look to gravitate to one end or the other of the barbell. So I suspect that, you know, and lots of the panelists have alluded to this, there are lots of good intent in this. Some of the aspects of the translation of that intent are also positive. But the details will not result in constructive outcomes unless they're addressed.
I think those are very valid comments, and I do believe that there will be representation made by various bodies. Dilli, if I can really request you, since you are, you know, representing SKS and Andhra, if you could give, you know, the various audience, I think we've now crossed a couple of hundreds who are on the call, a sense of what's happening on the ground in Andhra in terms of recoveries. Is there an awareness of the Maligam report? Is there a communication, a focused strategic communication being done by MFIs to clients to explain to them what's happening? And is this positive sentiment percolating to the client level? So what is really, you know, the tactical steps that are happening on the ground?
Royston, you know, before getting into the ground level operation, yes, strategies being worked out to say that this is the view of RBI. Now, I think Utpal referred to it. My only submission here is, yes, it's a committee report, but let's not forget that it's a high-powered committee, meaning it's a subset of the RBI board. It's not that, you know, like the earlier practice, an external academician is asked to share the recommendations and then RBI takes time to review it. It's really an executive body, not to say that it will come into effect today, but I'm just highlighting that point. Second aspect of that is, you know, I'll come to the AP thing. Before that, the point Ramesh referred to, and you also talked about Mr. Maligam's interview in a leading daily. Now, he has already talked about revisiting this 50,000 rupees. So the operational aspects, you know, the insight one is getting is that they'll be absolutely open, and RBI is an absolutely democratic regulator. They put the draft circulars for public review, put it in the public domain, invite views and correct it. So I think one could be a bit more optimistic out there. Now, the third point you talked about, the AP legislation, this is the point. You know, this is an excellent piece of regulatory framework done by subset of the RBI board. And most importantly, you know, when they make a request that the AP legislation be withdrawn, it's not a diktat. They have come out with 7 compelling merit-based arguments. And most importantly, they have assuaged the so-called concerns raised by whether it is AP government or, for that matter, any other state government. There's functional, you know, regulatory aspects which I talked about. It's a replete. It's a whole work. They are going to talk about transparency, pricing, interest rate cap. In fact, our position is that philosophically one is opposed to interest rate cap. But if that is what's going to buy you peace, and if that's what's going to assuage the concerns of the state governments, and it's worth it to bring in the regulatory certainty. So that's what I would say on that AP legislation.
Thank you so much. In terms of recoveries, Dilip, if you could just give us a sense of what's happening on the ground, how is that situation?
See, there's no one-to-one correlation between Malayagam Committee report and the collection as of date. But your assessment is absolutely right as we start disseminating this, saying that, and people do know of RBI. You know, end of the day, they use the currency notes. So that dissemination is being done at the industry level and the unit level, and we hope that it would have a positive change on that.
What I'd like to do now is to throw this open really to the participants for questions. The thing has already begun. You need to press the star one. The conference put us through the first question.
Thank you. Participants who need to ask a question may press star and one on their touchtone telephone. We have the first question from the line of Veena Bankar from Swadhar. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Royston.
Hi, Veena. Just to you and to all the other participants as well, if you could address it to a specific member of the panel, that's also fine.
Okay. I actually have this question for 3 members of the panel, and I'm taking off from Mona's comment on the narrow definition of microfinance. I have this question for Mona, Vijay, and Utpal, that looking at as an investor and as lenders to the sector, the institutions which choose not to fall into that narrow definition but still serve financial inclusion and probably a more difficult market because of the product development and time to stabilize, how would they look at those institutions and would they support them?
So can I go first?
Yeah.
See, as far as banks' funding is concerned, you know, it's not only priority sector which has been guiding funding to microfinance. Okay, priority sector, if you look at the total priority sector outstanding of the banking system in India, and if you look at total exposure to microfinance would really be a very small part of the overall priority sector. But what banks have been really looking at is a good commercial prospect which reaches a certain section of the population that banks otherwise cannot directly reach. And if the credit quality is good, if the underlyings are good, if the management has the faith of the bank, I'm sure most of the banks would go ahead and lend. So it depends on the individual organizations, whether they choose to come into the NBFC MFI sector or not. If their underlying business models are good, if rates of return to the banks are good, I mean, yes, it's always on.
Mona?
Yeah, I think there is a very strong business case and a very strong demand for products, credit products that go beyond what the Malayagam Committee has recommended. The amounts could be anything above 25,000 going up to 2 lakhs depending on the end use. So we are certainly supportive of business models that go into those areas. It remains to be seen how the final outcome of this, the final regulation looks at that business, but we definitely consider that as part of financial inclusion in the way that Ramesh also pointed out.
Okay.
Thanks, Mona.
And Vijay?
To be very frank, Veena, we're still trying to work out how to bail out the smaller organizations so that maybe, you know, left out in this whole purview of the committee's recommendation, which is accepted in full. But I'm sure in a week's time, we will also decide what should be the kind of a policy of Ananya, because I feel that 25,000 kind of a cap doesn't make a dent in the poverty level.
Mm-hmm.
So, but also, you know, I forgot to tell, because if you really see the experience between the urban and rural, because this amount is a single amount. So
yeah,
urban poor, rural poor, we have to make a distinction. In urban areas, I don't think 25,000 will bring in anything. And the income level is also something that we will find it very difficult to justify in urban areas, because it varies anywhere between 75,000 to 100,000 per household, because both husband and wife work in urban area and urban poor. But they also fall into the bracket of poor.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those clarification has to come. I'm sure that by the time we get the final version of it, approved version of it, this will be accommodated, because people are pointing it out. But it definitely Ananya also will take a look and define what we feel is a kind of a loan size that will impact the lives of the poor.
Thanks, Vijay.
Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes more, so you know, for the rest of those questions, if we could just have addressed to maybe one person on the panel and keep the answers brief.
Mm-hmm. We have the next question from the line of Rakesh Dubey from SV Credit Life. Please go ahead.
Hi, Rakesh.
Hi, Rakesh.
Hi.
So my question is that how all the panelists, they look upon the microfinance industry down to 2 years line, whether we are going to survive or not, because there are three serious issues which has been focused by the Malegaon committee. It is itself the definition of the microfinance. The second is that the funding towards the microfinance, my belief is that if the funding is not going to be available for the NBFCs, MFIs, how they are going to serve poor. The third is that itself the product, what a very monotonous kind of product. So they have left a very little choice to redesign the product. They concentrated only on the return on equity. They concentrated only on the margin rather than and the geographic area of the India.
Okay, so they're all three extremely valid points, I think. I think all in terms of the, you know, single product, the need to diversify the definition, as well as to sort of flagging those off and reiterating those. Thank you. Do we have the next question?
Sure. We have the next question from the line of Rafael Barabi from ISAF Microfinance. Please go ahead.
Hi, Royston and panelists.
Hi, Rafael. You're calling from South Africa, I think.
I'm calling from South Africa because this report caught my attention and caused me considerable concern. The positive aspects have been awesome. The negative aspect, you know, we are all familiar with the story of the person who drowned walking across a river with an average depth of 4 feet. So this committee has studied 9 large and 2 small finance companies with widely varying average costs and comes to the conclusion that a 9% cost, including the cost of provision, would be adequate. The average cost of the large companies themselves come to 13.7%. So the company has set cost standard 4% less than the average cost they themselves found. Going forward, I believe that the underserved market that would need to be accessed. The sector report shows that the stock markets are fully accessed. Our experience has been that entering the northern market, central India, eastern India is very, very much more expensive. Given a 24% cap and a 10 or 12% margin cap, I do not believe that any MFI entering the market today would be viable at this level of pricing.
I agree. You just endorsed my point.
Maybe I'll ask Dilli. Dilli, how do you see other state expansions happening where the cost of entering those states is going to be high? Would these margin caps be a disincentive to MFIs to expand into these underserved markets?
Vijayalakshmi should comment on this.
Okay, okay.
I
think I completely endorse the view, because that's what I have been telling, because if there is a bigger MFI which can balance its spread between developed state and the underserved states, then it is possible. But if there are homegrown MFIs that are operating only in underserved states, they will find it very difficult to manage with the kind of a spread that the committee has suggested. They do need substantial support in the form of a subsidized interest rate or whatever it is for 3 years.
So we will have only SKS and Spandana and a few others, and the rest will die.
Yeah, look, take for example even Andhra, the bigger MFIs who have operation other in other states could actually honor the repayment. But the MFIs that are operating only in Andhra Pradesh could not collect the money from the clients, and then they defaulted.
Thanks, Vijay. Maybe we could take another question, because we've got a long queue and we've got about 4 or 5 minutes left, so we don't want to...
Royston, with your permission, may I be excused, because unfortunately I have to jump into something else.
Okay. Ramesh.
Bye-bye.
So do you want to move on to the next question?
Yes, we can.
Sure. We have the next question from the line of Uday Ribello from BNP Paribas. Please go ahead. Mr. Ribello, your line has been unmuted. Please go ahead with your question. As there is no response from this line, we'll move on to the next question. It's from the line of Prakash Sundaram from India FinServe. Please go ahead.
Hi, Royston. This is Prakash. Hello.
Hi, we can hear you. You can just direct the question to whom you would like and state your question.
Dilly, I was just wondering, in terms of SKS' strategy, would it look at being a non-microfinance MFI? Because if you total the big MFIs, they practically represent more than 50-60%. So if the first four choose to be non-MFI NBFCs, then this entire report may lose its relevance, really.
No, I think, there's some fine reading required here. See, the definition restrains on the asset side. 90% has to be qualifying asset, but there's no restriction on the income side. And you and everybody know that in terms of this other products, there are two things I would say. There are many people who talked about it, there are very few walked. Second is, even those who are very successful in multiple product strategy, you always followed a principal and agency arrangement. You need to have a core lending product where you have the customer connection. And with that, you use the distribution network to distribute non-fund-based products and other financial products, and you make a fee income. There is no restriction on the income side here. It's on the asset side, because it's the core lending activity. Now, the second aspect of it is, I'm in complete agreement with what Vijay Madam and others talked about, the restraints or the so-called difficulties for the smaller units in scaling up to 15 crore net loan fund, etc., etc. But I'm absolutely confident that RBI would give the necessary, sufficient transitionary period. And please believe, it's an organization, regulator, who saved the country from several financial crises, including global crisis, and added balance to the global financial system. And they did exactly what we did with NBFCs. They started with 2 crores. That 2 crore was a big number in 98-2000, if I recall. They gave a transitionary path. And now, what is our onus? The industry participants and great leaders like Vijay Madam, now we should shift the debate to good versus bad rather than big versus small. So what it means, if there is smaller units, the regulator is coming in because he wants to mitigate the systemic risk. There are answers. So let's focus on the supervisory rating. Let's talk about qualitative aspects. Let's talk about management capability. Let's talk about sector leadership. Bring in all those things. Give a template acceptable to the regulator and let 1,000 flowers blossom.
Thank you. I think that was a great way to end the conference, but maybe we can just take one last question before we then have closing comments if we have
Sure. This is from the line of Jayendra Patel from Arvad Financial Services. Please go ahead. So that participant has taken his question out.
Okay, great. So as I said, I think that was a great last line, and I we are exactly an hour from which we started. So let 1,000 flowers blossom, I think Lily was your last line, and I think that's really the spirit of what Indian microfinance needs. I think the poverty issue is something that cannot be solved with 5 or 10 MFIs, but needs a significant effort for all to come together. As we all agree, I think there are some questions in terms of, what will happen if the interest rates harden since there's a fixed cap. But at the same time, there is openness, and as I heard you mention, the democratic nature of RBI to really elicit feedback once the draft guideline of the regulation is put on the website. So we are delighted to have, all you panelists on this. Thank you so much for being here. We've had a couple of hundred people dial in as participants to this. Our gratitude to you as well. I think truly Mission Millions has a long way to go to pull more clients out of poverty and then many, many more. On this note, thank you. The recording of this will be up and the link available, so you can feel free to contact us. Thank you once again for your attention and for being with us on this call. Look forward to more from Grameen Capital India.
Thank you.
Pleasure, and thank you,
Raj.
Thanks, ma'am.
Thank you, Raj. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Grameen Capital India, I would like to conclude this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.